I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Today we're going to have a slightly different format. We're going to be talking about a movie. And John and I have done movie podcasts in the past, and they have been popular. And so we decided we would do a movie podcast for our weekly show. And the topic is Christopher Nolan's Interstellar. So we've all rewatched the movie or watched the movie for the first time, I think in Mike's case, especially for this podcast. So John, why don't you begin and then we'll just share our initial impressions and then we'll start talking about the themes.
Well, I saw it in the theater with my girlfriend at the time when it first came out, and I was really blown away by it. It's definitely my favorite of Nolan's films, and that's saying a lot because I can't think of anything he's done that I don't like quite a bit. I like the fact that it was clearly modeled after what's long been my favorite film since I was a kid, which is 2001: A Space Odyssey of Kubrick. You know, the parallels with Interstellar are unmistakable, but I liked the fact that it's very much an implicitly conservative film in its theme and in what it depicts. And it was just a lot of fun. I mean, my girlfriend at the time and I went and saw it because she loved it as well, just as much as I did. We saw it three times in the theater. And I've seen it on video a couple of times since then. So, I've always thought it was, just an amazing piece of work. And every time I see it, there's parts of it that I just find incredibly moving. So it really doesn't get old for me.
So what did you think about it, Mike?
I was really quite blown away by it emotionally. It's, you know, the plot of dealing with the survival of humanity is compelling. And, you know, I like the science fiction aspects of it as well. This movie also confronts the fact that one day we will have to find a new planet. And spiritually, I think our mission is to head into the stars. And I think that's represented artistically in this film in a very moving way. And there are more thoughts I'll have on it as we continue the discussion. How did you enjoy it?
Well, I love it. I think it's a marvelous film. I was really busy at the time it came out in the theaters. I think it was it in 2014?
Yeah, October, November 2014.
Yeah, I was living in a place at the time. I was very, very busy, and I just didn't get out to see it when it was in the theater, and I really, really regret that now. There were a lot of things that had happened. I had just come back from Europe. A very close friend of mine died shortly after that, and I was just sort of under a cloud for a while, and I just didn't feel like going out, and I was in New York at the time, and going out in New York is a big rigmarole, so I just didn't want to go out and go to see that movie. I had other stuff I had to do, and so I just did what I had to do, and I would go home. So I missed it on the big screen, and I didn't see it on Blu-ray for like a year and a half, actually. And so I feel like I missed out on something very important. And I certainly rushed out to see Nolan's most recent film, Dunkirk, on the big screen as early as possible because I did not want to miss that experience. Let me just think. I didn't see any of his movies on the big screen until Inception. That was the first one I saw in a theater. And I saw it on the very last day it was running in San Francisco. And I got it by the skin of my teeth. And then I saw the Dark Knight Rises a couple years later. And I was very glad I saw that on the big screen. So his movies, they have scope. They have impact when you see them in the theater. But I've only actually seen three of them in the theater. And that's definitely something I'm missing. I hope that eventually I'll see all of the big ones again in theaters and like film festivals in the future, because I know that these movies are going to be shown many, many times in the future. They're classics. The guy is, I think, the most talented living filmmaker we've got, certainly of his generation. He's just done so many things that are classic now. And I think this is one of his best films. There's certain elements of it that I don't like. Let me just list a few of those. I find Matthew McConaughey's accent to be this weird, mush-mouthed, quasi-Texas, quasi-Midwest something or other, and it just sounds yes. whiny and twangy and fake. And I find that really annoying, it just grates on me. For some reason, it grates on me. And none of the other characters have that weird accent, so why he's using it, I do not know, but it bugs me. And I found some of the sci-fi elements to be just unsatisfactory, and the main element I found unsatisfactory was the fact that it turns out that somehow humanity, having survived its problems, is reaching back through time to fix the problem. It doesn't make any sense. It's a paradox, right?
It's not the first time that's been depicted in science fiction, but I don't know why they had to go with that rather than just say, well, it's some benevolent, super advanced aliens.
Yeah.
It seems like that would be just as satisfactory without the paradox. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So that irritated me, I have to say. And it just took a little bit of the suspension of disbelief away. But aside from that, it's an incredibly imaginative film. It's very, very gripping. It's, you know, 2.5 hours or longer, but it didn't seem slow to me. And the main thing about it that struck me, aside from the sheer imaginativeness of it, is just how emotionally powerful it is and how all those emotionally powerful moments center around the depiction of the family. It's a very, very conservative film in a lot of ways. It's a very, you know, family and survival and race, if you will, oriented film. And although there are black characters, it's a very white film overall.
Just the one kind of token main character. I think you see a couple of others, but
there was the black school principal or whatever near the beginning, and then there was the main black scientist who went on the mission. Yeah.
Of course, they all are acting very white anyway, so that doesn't even enter into the film.
Yeah, exactly. And it deals with interesting questions. It doesn't just present a worldview. It presents questions. And the big issue there is the conflict between being explorers and caretakers. I thought that was the most interesting conflict. The school principal or one of the teachers, I think, says, we're a caretaker generation. The context is that there has been some terrible civilizational collapse. And this civilizational collapse was somehow accompanied by war and famine and a regression technologically. The Earth's population is a lot smaller and food production is central. Economies seem to be simpler. Technology seems to be somewhat simpler. And there's this terrible blight that is destroying Earth's crops. One species at a time, wheat and then okra and then corn. Everyone's depending on corn and the corn is going to be the next to go, right? It's set somewhere in the Midwest. They're having these Dust Bowl-like experiences that really, they bring back the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. It's almost entirely white Midwestern types that are portrayed in the movie. And the children of this guy, who's played by Matthew McConaughey, are bright, but the world they live in does not allow people to chase their dreams, so to speak. And so the guy's told that his son doesn't have good enough grades to go to college and that he needs to become a farmer. And he's told that we're a caretaker generation, that we have to take care of things to get things going again. And that means that everyone's going to have to accept diminished ambitions. And of course, McConaughey was a pilot, like a NASA pilot at some point, but NASA apparently has been shut down. And actually, and this almost struck me as clumsy, the government teaches that the moon landings were fake. There's this political correctness where everyone is supposed to be taught that the moon landing is fake. Society is run by, you know, benevolent lies to accommodate people to their diminished horizons, basically. It's all about diminishing people's horizons. I mean, that's one of the issues. And you know, McConaughey says to his father-in-law, we used to be explorers, not caretakers, right? And the difference between an explorer and a caretaker is that an explorer goes beyond boundaries and sets new boundaries, whereas caretakers live within the boundaries that are set by other people. But we have to be both of these things. Settle down. We have to have homes. We have to till the earth and things like that. But I guess the point that's really being made is that you can't settle down and till the earth and survive without going beyond these boundaries. You need to have the explorer ambition, and you need to honor that so that the caretaker ambition can actually achieve itself. The way I put it in an essay that I found recently, I was going through drafts and I found this essay. Every people in history, including every extinct people, has tried to survive. Right? And just trying to survive obviously wasn't enough for all the ones that didn't survive. And I was trying to argue, and it was kind of inchoate, but I was trying to argue that in order to do the minimum of survival, you have to aim at more than just surviving. You've got to have a sense of destiny. And I think that that's sort of what's going on here. There's this theme of Faustian man and going beyond boundaries and exploring that is being brought up as central to our identity, basically. It's a very white movie. It's about white Faustian man.
Well, that's this quality that you describe. I mean, it's very specifically Western, because we've both been the biggest explorers the world has ever seen, but we've also retained this strong connection to the land and to our roots, or at least we did until very recently. I mean, if you go to India, as I have for a while, people are still people who live on the land, but it's become a very urban kind of society, and most people are kind of almost afraid of nature, I would say, in Asia. And, you know, I think that's why they've developed these religions that are very much about fearing nature. Mm-hmm. But you really, I think in the West, we've kind of developed this synthesis where we have this Faustian drive to transcend, and yet at the same time, you know, we recognize the importance of being rooted in something.
Exactly.
And, you know, and that's what you see at the end of Interstellar is, you know, they're in these space stations off Saturn, yet they've recreated this Midwestern kind of agrarian existence.
Exactly, with baseball diamonds and cornfields, and they rebuilt this guy's farmhouse as a museum.
Yes.
Piece because he was so important in their history. It was so charming. The McConaughey's character upbraids his daughter, who's now much older than he is because of the relativity of time when you're traveling close to the speed of light. He comes back, you know, and hasn't aged that much, but his daughter is an old lady. And he says to her very gently, "You told them I liked farming."
Yeah. Because in the beginning of the film, he comments about how much he dislikes it.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple of times.
And that sort of brings in a whole theme in the movie, too, which is lies and the function of lies. Because the society that is imposing this stay on Earth and be caretakers and stop reaching for the stars ideology is telling lies about the past to inure people to this new ideology. The professor Professor Brand, I think it is, who's played by, I'm blanking out his name.
Michael Caine.
He's lying to people to keep their hopes up. He says that he's going to be able to solve the gravity equation, right, that will allow them to leave the Earth and travel to another solar system. And he keeps people feeling hope that the people on Earth can survive, but that they can leave the planet and go somewhere else. But he doesn't believe that that's possible, and he thinks that the only possible survival of mankind will be by sending embryos out into the universe and repopulating a distant planet with frozen embryos and that the people on Earth are just all going to die. But of course, the people on Earth who are working to make this possible won't continue to work unless they feel that they can save themselves or their children can be saved. And so he tells this noble lie. And then when the problem of gravity has been solved by this woman, Murph, played by Jessica Chastain, who's the daughter of the pilot played by Matthew McConaughey, when that has been solved and mankind is leaving the solar system and going to this other planet far away, they have launched themselves into space, but they're recreating rootedness in space, a feeling of rootedness. And so what does she do? She tells this lie that her father loved to farm and that he liked rootedness when that was the furthest thing from him. And it's like, now that they're out in space, they need the rootedness even more. And so they recreate the Midwest in space. I thought that was an interesting theme and a kind of a beautiful theme that runs through it, and a morally questionable sort of thing. You can have a good moral debate about it.
Well, and of course, the other big lie in the film that's even more destructive is Dr. Mann's lie.
Oh yeah,
you know, when he sends out the signal that his planet is ideal for colonization, and then they get there and find out it was all just a ploy for them to come and rescue him.
Yes.
And he sort of plays the role that Hal does in 2001.
How so?
He's like Hal, you know, when in 2001, there's this crew that's on its way to Jupiter. And then Hal goes nuts and tries to kill them all, and actually does kill all but one. And then David Bowman, the character in 2001, he has to, in turn, kill Hal so he can, you know, proceed on to Jupiter, and then in the context of that film, you know, the next stage of human evolution. So I would say, the structure of if you compare the basic structure of Interstellar to 2001, it follows it very closely. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that that's what Nolan was going for. So Dr. Mann is, I mean, obviously he's not a computer like Hal was, but I think he sort of represents, because they emphasize in the film that he's the best of us, he's the most intelligent. I think he was the one who created this Lazarus project with Dr. Brandt, but he's actually gone nuts on this planet because he can't overcome his human frailty, you know, since we're not beings of reason alone. So that's why Matthew McConaughey and the, you know, Cooper and the other Dr. Brand, they have to defeat him so that he can go on to save humanity. So in the context of the story, I think Dr. Mann fulfills the same role that Hal does in 2001. He's a symbol of sort of the apotheosis of human reason, but reason on its own isn't enough, so it has to be overcome, either in the form of Hal or a mad scientist in this case, right, so that they can go on and realize, you know, the true destiny of man.
Right. The man character, who's played by, oh, I'm blanking out his name. This is so embarrassing.
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Yeah. The man character, played by Matt Damon, is hilariously awful. He's an unspeakable dick. And he's one of these people who basically is going to salvage a good opinion of himself no matter how badly he behaves. And
right,
the scene where he tries to kill Matthew McConaughey, and he just keeps babbling on, and he's like, I'm killing you, but I'll be there for you. I'll talk you
right
through this. And
right,
then he starts saying, are you seeing your children's faces? He's such a fucking creep. He's so creepy. And then, of course, when he gets his comeuppance, when he kills himself, because he won't listen, because he just thinks that somehow the rules of physics and mechanics don't apply to him. Yeah, and he's, of course, going to escape and basically kill these people and probably, lose humanity's last chance of survival. He's babbling on, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing it for all mankind. And then he's
right
blown up.
Well, that's just also, that's again like Hal in 2001, is he's killing off the whole crew, he tells David Bowman, I'm not going to allow you to endanger the mission.
Because,
you know, Hal has come to see the mission as being
identical, you know, with him, yeah.
Right, it's the same with Man.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny that his name is Man, whereas Hal, of course, was Machine, but...
Well, I think Nolan's right. I mean, the true danger still comes from other humans more than machines.
Yeah.
My take on that is that he was trying to get to the embryos to execute Plan B somehow on that barren planet that he was on, because I think it was actually possible. It would have been a really hard life for humanity to have continued on there. But I think he had deluded himself. He had, you know, reached this planet and sent out the false signal because he couldn't overcome his human frailties and his loneliness. And that's another big theme throughout the whole movie. It's just the loneliness of space travel and, you know, the attachments we form and love, you know, the love for your family and for other people, and just how what a strong motivating factor that can be, both for good and for evil.
Right. I disagree with one small thing that you said, Mike. I don't think he was going to try and make a home on the planet that he was marooned on.
There's no surface.
There is no surface to it, and there was no atmosphere there. He said there was, but there wasn't. I think he was going to take the spaceship and go to the third planet, and that's the one that they ended up going to. That was the only one of the three where there was any possibility that humanity could survive. So I think he was going to go to the third planet. And I forget the name of the planet and the name of the scientist who was there, but that's the planet that they go to. And it's so beautiful at the end of the movie, because McConaughey's character has somehow survived and he's been brought back to Earth. And his daughter says, you know, I don't want you to stick around and watch me die. You have to go back out there. You know, you've got to go track down the other Dr. Brand, the young Dr. Brand, who's gone on to this third planet.
Well, and Cooper himself says, when they bring him back to his farm that they've reconstructed, mm-hmm. and he says, oh, I don't much like this pretending we're back where we started.
Yeah.
That would be, if it was a more pastoral film, that's what they would have gone with. That's, you know, like, oh, look, he's back on his farm. He's happy now.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't want to go back to Hobbiton. Yeah.
Right.
You know, he's an adventurer. You know, he's an adventurer and a warrior. And apparently, you know, the daughter's describing how Dr. Brand is on their new world and settling down and maybe going to hypersleep. And he has to go and find her. And I almost wish that they had said, awaken her, because it would be so mythical, right? It's like the Sleeping Beauty story. But that's what was being communicated. You know, the knight has to go back out on another quest. He has to go to, not to a simulacrum of the Earth they've left behind, but the new world they're going to create. And he has to help the woman who's there, marooned there, waiting for them. You know, to get the world ready for humanity. So it's a powerful, powerful ending, full of hope. And you love this character, Cooper, because he really is just, you know, he's the explorer. He's the mechanically competent, brave, questing, Faustian explorer type. He just can't settle down and take care of things and live within the boundaries set by others. And thank God we find people like this, because they're the ones who are going to take us to the stars.
Yeah, exactly. I think another important theme in the film is time in many senses. One thing that I noticed is, you know, those clips of older folks talking about what happened to the Earth that are at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And you see them again at the end, but, you know, Cooper's farm has been kind of turned into a museum on this space station. And, you see those same clips are being shown on screens. I actually read that Nolan got those from a pre-existing documentary about the Dust Bowl. And those are actual Dust Bowl survivors talking about their experiences. And I was thinking, you know, this is a multi-million, you know, God only knows how much money was spent on this film. I'm sure if Nolan had wanted, he could have gone and gotten actors to shoot those scenes, but he chose to use these actual Dust Bowl survivors. And I was thinking, you know, it kind of sends an interesting message about time repeating itself, which I think is also embodied in this idea that, you know, even when humanity goes out to Saturn, they always return to this kind of, you know, rural Midwestern style existence. But, you know, with important differences, of course, being that, you know, like you said, it's in tandem with this Faustian drive. I thought that was very interesting that in a way, you know, history does repeat itself, but not exactly. You know, there's changes as time goes on. And yeah. The other interesting thing, I think, and what the scene that moves me the most is that scene when he's in the Tesseract in the fifth dimension or wherever he is in the black hole. And he sees himself saying goodbye to Murph. And he tries to persuade himself not to go, which of course is impossible, as he learns that he can't change the past. And he's in tears. And I always just found that really moving because I think we all, you know, I'm sure all of us at some point or another, we find ourselves thinking about something that we did that we regret, and we wish we could go back and change it. But, you know, there's, of course, simply no way. And you know, it's all the more devastating for Cooper at that moment because he could actually see it and he still can't do anything. I always just found that very moving. There's something extremely human about that moment. Of course, then he finds out that the real reason he's there is to save humanity, and then things get a lot better. But it doesn't take away from the power of that moment for me.
Right.
Well, what are some of the other major themes that you guys picked up on in this?
Well, to go back to the whole issue of lies and big lies and little lies, you know, just the theme of that some lies can be noble lies when they're told for people to maintain hope, to not panic, not give up, you know, like the Dr. Brand's lie, although arguably should have told at least a few other more trusted people instead of keeping it to himself entirely, his entire life, which was quite an irresponsible thing. But then when they're on the ship, Dr. Brand's daughter and Coop are having this little discussion, and they basically establish right then that it's not a good thing for them to be 100% honest with each other, that they have to kind of tell little lies just to be able to live with one another. And in fact, the robots on the ship, they have an adjustable setting, a truth setting that the humans can modify to make it to tell little jokes and little lies. Just so the sheer loneliness and the sheer horror of the actual situation they're in doesn't just completely overwhelm them. Because if you are 100% honest about everything that's wrong and everything that you have to deal with, that actually can be a negative thing. I mean, just from a psychological health perspective. So I thought that was an interesting thing that the movie dealt with as well.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about how the lie theme enters in with the honesty settings on the robots. Yeah, that's interesting.
Honesty and humor.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, this is something they've been seriously discussing. You know, especially as, you know, they're still talking about possibly sending a manned mission to Mars. But, you know, the early years of spaceflight missions rarely lasted, you know, more than a few days or a couple of weeks. So, you know, these social dynamics weren't quite as important. But I've read that, you know, NASA's concerned about, you know, what do you do if you send a crew and it takes them 2 years or whatever to get to Mars and they're in these very close quarters and some of the people hate each other? I mean, unless they're extremely psychologically stable, you know, that could end up in disaster. And I know they've been experimenting with this with the International Space Station, you know, where some of the people stay up for long periods of time. And I've, you know, they've had problems there with crew members who didn't get along. So it's a good theme for the film because it depicts, you know, this ideas about human nature like we've been discussing. But Yeah, I find that quite interesting, that aspect of travel, just simply getting along with one another. Another thing that I think is important to discuss, although he's kind of a minor character, is Tom, Cooper's son, who kind of turns into this kind of reactionary figure in the film where, you know, he gives up on their father. You know, he's convinced he's dead. He seems to be kind of bitter about it, sort of like Murph, you know, thinks that he abandoned them. But he seems to think that everything that Murph is doing is nonsense. And it's kind of interesting to me that his house ends up being on the space station, because I'm thinking either eventually he changed his mind and went along into space with everybody else, or, you know, I guess maybe he died and they took the house after. But you never really find out what happens to him, because the last you see him is when Murph confronts him about the health of his family. You know, and he's railing about, oh, you want me to go and live underground like you do, you know, like a coward. I'm not going to do that. And in a way, I guess you could see him as almost like a right wing figure, but not in a positive sense. Like he's just resistant to any sort of change and, you know, is convinced. I guess you could say he's more of a conservative, you know, that he wants to perpetuate his life as he's always known it, and thinks that any talk of change is nonsense, sort of as embodied in Murph, the scientist.
Right. He's the opposite of his father. His father's the explorer, and he's the stay-at-home. He's the guy
right.
who's trying to desperately make it work. And he's stubborn and refuses to see that it's not working. And, you know, one of his children dies, and the other is sick, and his wife is sick. And he refuses to listen to the necessity of leaving. So he's basically just the opposite of his father. He's the opposite archetype of his father. And he's in there to give us balance, I guess, to show us, obviously, humanity will not survive if we're like this guy. And we basically just settle down and adapt to the limits that have been created for us. He's the perfect guy for the caretaker state, but we need more than that if we're going to survive. And very clearly, his wife and his child need more than that if they're going to survive. And of course, humanity needs, in a broader sense, more than just the caretaker state to survive.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think that he's sort of a dramatization of that dichotomy that you mentioned.
The rootedness principle, yeah.
Right, but taken to an extreme, unhealthy extreme.
Exactly.
And Cooper, I guess that's why he's sort of the hero, because he is the explorer, but he can be the caretaker. And even though he doesn't like farming, family is still very important to him. And that's another major theme of the film is, you know, him trying to get back to his family.
Yeah, that's so important to him. And he wants to save them. He does not want to go to Plan B. Plan A is saving the people who are on the Earth. Plan B is just sending basically embryos out into space and hoping that somehow the Earth can survive. So he wants Plan A, and he's desperately trying to get back so he can save his family. And it's that desire to get back and save his family that ultimately leads to saving everybody. And that's important. The whole element of love as a theme in the movie is very important.
Yes. I have to say that's one part of the film that kind of grates on me a little bit, is that one scene where the female Dr. Brandt,
Amelia,
on the ship, Amelia, she talks about how, you know, her lover, this guy named Edmonds, who we never see, he's on that third planet that we only see at the very end, and he's clearly already dead, because you see she's having the robot bury him. And she gives that long monologue about, well, maybe we need to stop figuring this out with scientific theory and go with love, because it transcends space and time. And I'm like, would any scientist really, I mean,
you know,
she's clearly a very accomplished scientist, say, oh, we should just forget all about science and just go with our hearts.
She should have just said, look, I do have a bias here, but the facts speak for themselves, and if you want to look at the facts, look at the facts. But when she does that, she completely loses them. They both say, well, we're not going with this with you, we're going to go to this other planet, man's planet, which turns out to be yes. the wrong place. But she wanted them to do the right thing, but for the wrong reason. But then that love theme comes back when he's in this Tesseract thing in the black hole, and it's talked about again that love is this force that's drawing him toward a solution.
Well, that made I didn't mind that so much because it makes sense.
Yeah, but, yeah, it does.
Yeah. But I think that's why I'm probably biased because I love Kubrick. I would still consider 2001 to be the better film, but I think that. Just in an artistic sense, but I think that Interstellar has advantages over 2001, and one of them is this sort of humanness quality.
Oh yeah, it's a very human film.
I mean, there's no trace of love in 2001, or
no.
This sense of rootedness. It's not present. So Interstellar is a much warmer, more human take on the same theme, I would say.
I just wanted to go back to what you were saying earlier, John, about Dr. Amelia Brand being biased in favor of this Edmund's planet. Actually, I think in the movie she said that even though there was no data still coming from Edmund's planet, whereas man was still transmitting, that the data they received from the Edmund's planet was actually better data.
Right, yeah.
So...
And we see that at the end. I mean, when you get to glimpse that planet, it's clearly much more hospitable than the other two planets that they saw.
Right, right. So it was reasonable for her to want to choose that planet as well as being drawn towards it because of love. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, there was a logical reason. But I have to say, if I had been in that situation only knowing what they knew, I probably would have gone with Cooper and the other guy. Just because, well, this guy's still transmitting. I mean, obviously, if the other guy died, that's probably not a very good indicator of his planet. So, you know, I think they actually did make the right decision. They just didn't know that they were being lied to.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It's an interesting question about how do we allow feelings to interfere with our decisions, and sometimes that's right, and sometimes that's wrong, so.
Yeah. What was man's reason for wanting to kill Cooper? Did he think that he needed to do that in order to get to Edmund's planet?
I think he was planning to kill all of them, because he knew when they figured out that he had lied, that, you know, he'd be up shit creek. You know, and he knew that it wouldn't take them long to figure out that he'd been lying about the data. So I think he was planning to, well, he does kill, what is the black scientist's name? I can't remember. But, you know, he would have killed Cooper if he'd been a little more skilled, and he offed the other guy, and he probably would have taken out Amelia as well. Yeah, which is why I said his role parallels that of Hal in 2001, because mm-hmm. Hal tries to kill off the rest of the crew, because they're going to figure out that he lied about something.
So he thought he was going to have a death sentence put upon him unless he, you know, executed everybody else.
That's my interpretation of it. I guess, well, we know that he tried to kill Cooper. He killed the black guy. We don't know what his plans were for Amelia. Maybe he thought he could persuade her, you know, that he was doing the right thing. But I don't know. We'll never know that for sure. But
yeah,
he clearly planned to kill off at least some of them.
Yeah. Well, there was an incredibly human moment just when he was waking up out of stasis, and he just, you know, was overcome by emotion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something you could definitely relate to.
Yeah, that's another, I would say, very... Well, there's a few moments that just really tug at my heartstrings. That's one, the one where Cooper tries to prevent himself from leaving, but also the scene where... The first planet that they go to, and I think it's something like 23 years pass on Earth while they're only down there for a few hours.
Yeah.
And when they come back, and then Cooper's watching these 23 years of videos of his kids. And I found that very moving.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
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 The black scientist's name was Dr. Romilly. And they Dr. come back, Romilly. Yeah, and he's aged 23 years waiting on the station while they're just down there for a few hours. It's very, very touching, the whole setup. But yeah, when he watches those videos, it's very touching. And it's also very touching at the end when he sees his daughter and all of her descendants around.
His descendants.
His descendants, yeah.
Yeah. And he's younger than most of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a great moment as well.
The movie was, I thought, as science fiction goes, extremely convincing, except for the time travel paradox thing, which irritated me. I love just how imaginative it was in certain ways. Like, they go to the first world, and they find that the world is covered with shallow water, but there are these enormous waves, you know, that tower so high, and, they have to escape that. It's like, wow, what an interesting thought. And of course, the waves are so high because it's so close to the edge of this black hole. And so there's this gravitational force that's pulling the ocean around and creating these giant, giant waves. And of course, they find the wreckage altogether of the ship that came there. And they say, well, the reason it's all together is that it arrived there decades, more than a decade before, maybe. But only an hour or so had passed on that planet.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is strange and wonderful. I really enjoyed just how imaginative that was. That was an alien landscape that never would have occurred to me. So it just was wondrous. And also, man's planet was interesting too, because apparently they were walking around on frozen clouds. You know, there were all these layers of clouds, that the clouds were solid. And so man had set his ship down and built his camp on a cloud. But the clouds are all frozen and solid. And then they talk about descending from the clouds to the surface. You know, but of course there's no habitable surface below. That was just all a lie. But I thought that was a very, very interesting idea, that the world was covered with frozen layers of clouds that you could live on and walk on.
I guess that's theoretically possible.
Yeah.
Although I was wondering how, because you see some of them just kind of hanging in the sky. You have to wonder what's keeping them up, because when they're walking around, it seems like it's normal Earth gravity.
Yeah.
So, well, I've read a few articles which said that, like, some of the science in the film is good, and some of it is just kind of made up. So maybe that's kind of a suspension of disbelief sort of thing, that you could, you could have all these frozen clouds just hanging there, in normal gravity. But yeah. I can't think that maybe there's something I've never seen, but the way they depicted the effects of relativity, the conceit in a lot of science fiction is that, well, you know, somehow humanity has figured out this way to travel faster than light that causes no time distortion. Time just proceeds normally, which, you know, as far as anyone knows, that's physically impossible. But yeah, it's been depicted in a few science fiction books I could think of. There's a really interesting novel called The Forever War, which was written in the 70s by this Vietnam veteran named Joe Haldeman. And it's set in a future where humanity's at war with this alien species all over the galaxy, and the ships, you know, the Earth's military travels around in these ships that travel at the speed of light. And the soldiers, even though while only a few months are going by for them, like decades are going by on Earth. So every time they come back, Earth is completely changed. So it's the only other, I'm sure there's other written science fiction works that have dealt with it, but it's a very fascinating sort of trope, you could say, of science fiction that I thought they dealt with in a very interesting way in this film.
They did take care of the gravity issue by having the endurance spinning in a circle as it travels
through
the galaxy. And that's, like, you know, one of the technical problems of space travel that, has to be dealt with.
It's also, not ironically, very logically, something they also did in 2001 aboard the Discovery.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is like yet another nod to Kubrick there.
Yeah.
Although, of course, scientifically, that is a way to simulate gravity in space. So,
yeah. Another thing that really resonated with me is the whole, as you guys were saying, the time issue and the sense of estrangement from one's family because you're pursuing an inconvenient and politically incorrect truth. You know, I think everybody who's involved with this has had to pay this price to some degree. And to see the equivalent of that in this film was quite moving.
Yeah, that's a really good point. One thing that's worth talking about is Hans Zimmer's music, because that is it's very effective. It's very good music. And
I actually own the soundtrack because I sometimes put it on when I'm working.
Yeah,
I find it very inspirational.
And of course, the sort of theme of it, the inspiration of it, it harkens to 2001 A Space Odyssey, because it feels like the entire soundtrack is constructed out of the organ pedal that runs through the Richard Strauss Sunrise fanfare from also Sprach Zarathustra.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I really felt that was the source of it, that it's this, because it's mostly organ music, or quite a lot of organ music. And so anyway, it's very, very 2001-like in a certain way. It doesn't sound like it, but it's constructed from elements of it into a very modern and minimalistic kind of score, but it's quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in that scene where they're trying to dock with the Endurance after Dr. Mann has screwed it up. That's a very powerful piece, organ piece, which I believe I heard it was left off the original soundtrack release for whatever reason. And so many people demanded that they put it on, that they released a special edition that had that included.
Oh, well, that's
if I'm remembering that correctly, that's the one I have. I think it's just called something like Docking or something like that. But it's quite a moving piece of music. Organ music. Maybe Nolan actually said to Zimmer, like, well, listen to Zarathustra and then and then come up with your own score or something like that. Well, how do you think this relates to Nolan's other work? Yeah, we've all noted how implicitly conservative this film is, which, of course, we could say the same for the Batman films. I'd say it's less of a factor in Inception and Memento. Oh, and it's certainly also, of course, in Dunkirk, as we discussed recently. That's an implicitly conservative film, too. So how do you think this fits in with Nolan's oeuvre, as they say?
That's a good question. Well, a lot of his films really make you think that, frankly, America, even huge cities in America, like Gotham City, are very white places. And it's something that's been commented upon. And yes, he does have Morgan Freeman in various places, a black mentor, a black scientist, whatever. These roles are there, but the movies are overwhelmingly racially and normatively white, I think. And that's certainly true of Interstellar. And the fact that it's set in the Midwest, primarily with Midwestern farm types, I think is definitely a very, very white gesture. It's like white flyover country, you know.
Definitely a lot of Trump supporters in
exactly.
The earth sequences in that film.
Yeah, and the life that these people lead, they are farmers, they have small towns, they play baseball, they work for NASA. I mean, this is all uber white stuff. And it doesn't go unnoticed by people. I think it's part of the appeal of his movies to a lot of people, and maybe one of the reasons why some people don't like him. So those are definitely very prominent. And then of course, there's the emphasis on the theme of family. There's the emphasis in which is very central and very powerful. There is the Faustian technological theme and the explorer theme, which is so close to the identity of European people. And it is uber European. Then there is the struggle, the conflict between the desire for rootedness and the desire for exploration. I mean, that is a struggle that we all face as a race. We are not just people who have roots. We also have wings. So getting those things together is important. And then there's another element of it that's very, very conservative, and that really is the element of lies. And by that I mean just the recognition that society doesn't run on truth alone, and human relationships don't run on truth alone. We can't be fully frank, or we'll start hating each other. That's why we have to have the humor setting and the honesty setting on the robots, right? And in our human interactions as well. And if society doesn't run entirely on facts, well, what does it run on? Well, it runs on opinion. And another great lie in the movie is that although the public is told that NASA didn't even happen, there's still a NASA, but in secret. Why? Because the public wouldn't support it. Even though, of course, they're educating the public in such a way that they wouldn't support it. It's all very, very peculiar. So that element is, I think, implicitly conservative, though. Of course, the left tells lies, too. Everyone tells lies. But the underlying assumption that society cannot be based simply on facts, and that human interactions can't be based simply on facts, that we have to respect opinion and people's feelings, and perhaps even open the door to things like tradition and so forth, I think does point to some kind of conservative element here. Although, of course, we're supposed to be contemptuous of the lies that the government is telling, saying that the space program is fake, right? But still, there are noble lies in here, like the elder Dr. Brand's lie, which he thinks is necessary to keep people working. And of course, man understood that and explained to them the lie, which I thought was really interesting. Brand understood this. And of course, he's the best of them. He was probably very close to the elder Dr. Brand's thinking. But, you know, then he discovers that he's more of a man and less of a machine than he thought he was.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that this is clearly, I think that's kind of funny, that scene in the beginning, though, where Cooper kind of has that tiff with the principal of the teacher, because, you know, I think it is sort of, you know, even though it's something that's not real, it is sort of implicitly a critique of political correctness, because, you know, that's what they've been trying to do for the last couple of decades, is rewrite American history in the schools. We know that. Like, yeah. I haven't been in school since the 80s, but I have friends who are raising kids who tell me that in schools today, you know, basically Martin Luther King is depicted as the epitome of humanity. You know, he was the most important person who ever lived. so, yeah, I think it was sort of a dig at that sort of rewriting of history.
Oh, this just came to mind. The whole notion of, you know, time compression and relativity, and that you can experience time passing more quickly in one place than another, that appeared in Christopher Nolan's Inception as well.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're right.
As the progressive dream states and dreams within a dream and whatnot, and the deeper dream states that you get into, the slower time seems to pass. So I thought that was interesting to see a different variation on that theme.
Yeah, exactly. A whole lifetime can pass in this deepest dream state while, you know, only an hour or two is happening in the real world. So,
right.
Yeah, that's very interesting. One thing that struck me as kind of beautiful is early on in the movie, Coop says to Murph that her mother, his wife, said that once they had kids, that really what they are is just to be, did she say memories or ghosts?
Ghosts,
for their children.
Because then that then relates to the ghost behind her bookcase.
Yeah, he is the ghost.
Right.
He turns out to be the ghost, the poltergeist that's moving things, trying to send messages to her. So I thought that was a nice little bit of literary prefiguring, a little bit of literary prophecy.
Yeah, a little foreshadowing.
Yeah.
It's also just an interesting theme in itself, the idea that, as you know, once you become a parent, then You know, you're just there to, I think the exact quote is, you're just there to be memories for your kids.
Right.
Because that is true. I mean, you know, everything you do in front of your kids for the first, you know, 15 or 20 years of their lives is going to determine, well, not entirely, but, you know, to a large extent, determine who they're going to be as people. So that's, it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah. And the sort of the assumption is you've got to use yourself up for your kids. You're not saving yourself anymore. You're spending yourself on them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And if we believe that all those people in Murph's hospital room at the end are her kids, apparently she had a lot of them.
Yeah, which is a wonderful thing.
And yes.
It's a very nice message, because here's a woman who had a career, and yet she had a huge progeny who came to be by her side.
You know, mm-hmm.
It's a lovely, lovely, again, very conservative image.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you see any of those kids earlier in life. I mean, she doesn't have any children, you know, before she figures out the equation, right?
She has that guy who goes with her to the farm.
Who you can assume is the dad, but you don't know.
Yeah, he's sure. You know, when she figures it all out, she gives him a big kiss. So once humanity had a future, she got down to business and started having kids.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to wrap here? We've been going at it for about an hour.
Actually, could I just mention one last thing that just came to mind?
Yeah, sure.
I was just thinking, I just last week I rewatched a film, because they were showing it at the Art House Theater here in Budapest, one of them. It reminded me a bit of this film. Have you seen Children of Men? It came out about 10 years ago.
No, I haven't, actually.
That might be worth doing a podcast on at some point, but it's set in, I think, the year 2027, and the premise is that the film came out, I think, in 2007. Then in 2009, there's this global flu epidemic, and in the aftermath, all the women in the world are sterile. So by 2027, the youngest person in the world is 18. And, you know, science has been unable to figure out any way to make women fertile again. And it's about, sort of this world that has grown up, knowing that, you know, they're going to be the last generation on Earth. That's the only way in which it relates to Interstellar, is in the fact of, you know, this humanity not knowing if it has a future or not. But it's, in some ways, it's the exact opposite, because in that one, everyone knows and humanity sort of goes insane collectively. So it could relate to this theme of lies and when you need to tell lies and so forth, because in that film too, there's a number of interesting, various political factions are trying to develop narratives for their own purposes in the film. So yeah, I don't know, that might be a film worth discussing at some point, because it approaches the same problem, but from a very different angle, you could say. Humanity sort of discovering a new future for itself.
Yeah, that's a very interesting movie. I just ordered a copy of it, so I will watch it, and we will prepare. All right, well, this is, I think, a good time to wrap up. So we will definitely be doing more regular weekly podcasts with the normal format, and we will continue also doing movie review podcasts as well.
Absolutely.
Well, great, guys. Thanks so much. And everybody out there, join us again next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.